As a small business owner, have you ever felt overwhelmed by the pressure of choosing the right hire or leading a team? Or have you ever found yourself tolerating a bad hire because you fear trying and failing again as you repeat the hiring process? If so, you're not alone, and you are in the right place. Welcome to the Growing Your Team podcast. The Growing Your Team podcast teaches business owners like you to expand your unique business by teaching you to master the hiring and team management process. Hiring and managing a team does not have to be a challenge. You just have to learn to do it right. And the Growing Your Team podcast teaches you how to become a confident leader who hires right every single time. Now, let's jump into the show where each episode you will learn tips on how to identify what type of help you need on your team, how to source amazing candidates, how to conduct interviews that lead you to your ideal team member, how to onboard successfully, and how to lead every person in your business so you have a team of rock stars who you are happy to pay every single paycheck. So let's jump in and teach you how to hire like a pro. Hello, Jamie Van Kuyk here, and welcome back to the Growing Your Team podcast. Today, I have on guest Marcel Petipa. Marcel is the CEO and co-founder of Paraquito, a company dedicated to helping agencies measure and improve their profitability by streamlining their operations and reporting systems. He is also the head strategic coach at SaaS Academy by Dan Martel, the number one coaching program for B2B SaaS businesses in the world. In his work as a speaker, podcast host, and consultant, specializing in agency profitability optimization, he's helped hundreds of agencies around the world measure the right metrics and improve their operations and profitability without relying on financial data and accounting professionals, and take control of their business with simple numbers anyone can understand and measure. When he's not helping agencies make more money, he's probably watching The Office or Parks and Rec on a never-ending loop and eating breakfast foods for every meal of the day. I know I say a lot of times that I'm super excited about episodes and interviewing guests, but this episode really excites me. It is right up my alley because we're talking a lot about numbers and data, but we're talking about it in a way that should make sense, even if you're not a numbers person. We're talking about the numbers that you really need to know in your business if you want your business to be profitable, and how to look and dissect these numbers. So if you're not profitable or don't have the profitability that you want, what you can really adjust in order to get there. We talk about the pros and cons of making some of these adjustments, all with the goal of making sure you're happy with the results and that your team is not being overworked just to make your numbers look good. So let's jump into this episode so you can learn all about how to be profitable in your business by looking at and measuring the data that actually matters. Hi, Marcel. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Growing Your Team podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, I'm excited for today's conversation. But before we get into everything, can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Marcel Petipa, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of a company called Paraquito, and we specialize in helping service businesses measure and improve their profitability and really get an understanding of how the decisions they make every day about people, projects, and time actually impact the financial outcome for the business and feel a sense of ownership and control over those things without getting overwhelmed in data.
Yes. Yeah. So I know for me, I'm just like, oh, I love data. So I'm so excited about this conversation, but I know there's a lot of people out there that data is just not their thing. Like, they avoid it. And then sometimes they're going back and someone forces them to look at it. They're like, oh, I didn't even know that was going on. So just high level, why should we be tracking data? And at the bare minimum, what should we be looking at?
Yeah, well, it's a good question. I think if you've run a business and you've ever kind of gotten to the end of the year and gone to that, you know, meeting with your accountant where you basically find out if things went well or they went poorly and you have no idea what to expect, and maybe you've been unpleasantly surprised, that is essentially the reason why you might want to start tracking these things. And other symptoms that people tend to feel when they come to see us are things like, you know, the business is growing, but I'm making less money as a founder. How is that possible? Or, you know, we have more work coming in than we've ever had. And my team is super busy, and yet we're still struggling with cash flow, and I almost missed payroll last week, and I can't figure out how it's possible that we have more revenue, and yet our cash flow problems are getting worse, and we're just not that profitable, and it's feeling like I can't afford to hire the people that I need to hire, and my accountant's telling me I'm overstaffed, and my team is telling me I'm overworked, and I just don't know how to figure out what's happening. That is probably a good sign that there are some issues in the business that a few simple numbers could help you understand why these things are happening and what to do about it. And feeling empowered is ultimately the outcome that we're looking for when we start to track these things.
Yeah. So listening to what you just said, a lot of it seems to do with money and cash flow. So is it money and cash flow, the data that we're tracking, or is it something else that kind of impacts that money?
Yeah, it's a good question. And really the framework that we've developed is about creating an intersection between three important parts of the business. The first is the financial lens of the business, which is ultimately the retroactive scoreboard for how did the business perform. And that's the key word is retroactive. Financials inherently are about reconciling things that have happened in the past. And so they're great for getting an understanding of how have things gone. They're not that great for getting an understanding of what decision do I need to make today. So the second piece of that connection is understanding operations and having some metrics that allow us to measure how the decisions we make every day are going to actually influence the financial impact for the business and start to take control over those things so that we can direct the business more intentionally towards where it wants to go. And then the last piece is sales and marketing and getting an understanding of how the things that are on the leading edge of the business, the kinds of work that we bring in, the kinds of clients that we target, how we price and scope different engagements with clients, how that's going to impact those other two areas of the business. And what we find is that often founders or, you know, teams within a business are looking at financials. They might have some stuff going on in sales and marketing. They might have a couple of metrics on the operations side, but those things are not really interconnected and the relationship between them is not clear. And that is really where we look to bridge the gap and create a framework that allows us to really understand how one change in one area of the business should be impacting everything else.
Yes, yes. I love that. You know, really looking at those different areas, because as you mentioned, your financials are really that lagging metric. It's what already happens. There's nothing you can do to go back and change that. And if you don't make the changes in the other areas, you don't measure the other things, your financial status is most likely not going to change.
Yeah. Yeah. And we've all, I'm sure, had that conversation. It's a little bit frustrating where we're talking maybe to our accountant or whoever's in charge of our books and we're looking at our financials and they're like, yeah, you're not that profitable. And you're like, okay, well, why? And what do I do about it? And that's where the conversation kind of starts to stall out. They're like, I don't know. You're the one running the business. Like, you tell me why you're not performing well. And then you start to wonder, like, what am I paying you for it? And the answer is like, you're probably just paying them to do your taxes. And that isn't their job to tell you that. And you could look at that as a problem or you could look at it as an opportunity. And so hopefully today, what we can talk a little bit about is, first of all, what should you be getting from your financial statements? Because you're already spending time and money there. So are there some tweaks we can make to make those more valuable? But then how do you start to take control over that outcome by really understanding how to measure the operations of the business and set yourself up for success every day when you make decisions about people, projects, and time?
Ooh, sounds good. All right. Well, let's jump into that. So financials, what should we be looking at? What are those measurements?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by just talking generally about business, but then I'll talk about the nuances of services in particular, because this is, I think, an area of business that is not very well measured on a general P&L that is being, you know, that we're applying like general accounting practices to, or that are being done by an accountant that is purely focused on tax. So the lifeblood of any business from a profitability perspective is gross margin. And there's two ways that we can look at gross margin. We can look at contribution margin, which is, you know, when I sell a thing to a customer, what is like the direct amount of profit that that generates for us? So if I sold chocolate bars, for example, it's like when I sell you a chocolate bar, it costs me 20 cents to make it. I sell it to you for a dollar. I made 80 cents in contribution margin there. And then you have the second level of gross margin, which is gross margin as a business. And there we're starting to look at things like, okay, well, I have this factory where we make chocolate bars, and maybe I'm not utilizing that factory at 100%, or maybe we have some defects or we have some quality issues. And so we're throwing out 20% of the chocolate bars that we make. And so the margin there might be a little bit lower because we're capturing kind of the inefficiency of running the production of that thing. And then ultimately you're going to have overhead, and then hopefully there's enough left over for you to have a profit. And so the objective really is to have healthy enough gross margins and contribution margins such that you can pay for running the business, sales and marketing and administration and facilities, and then have enough money left over. And in a professional services business, the thing that is complicated about that is most P&Ls, when we look at them, the gross margin of the business is not really easy to see, because the majority of the cost is actually payroll. And that payroll is usually in one big account, and everybody goes in there no matter what their job is, whether they work on sales or they do client work or they do a combination of those things. And so the first thing that we really encourage people to do is to start separating out two sets of expenses related to the work that they do. The first is what we call delivery expenses, which is what is it actually costing you to get work done for clients? So let's say you run an architecture firm, client hires you to draft these large plans for a new building. You want to make sure that you understand, okay, well, who worked on this and how much time did they work on it? And how much did that time cost us as a business? So we can understand, what did we actually spend to earn this revenue? And when your P&L is set up in a way where all of your payroll goes into one account, it's very hard to see that. So that's kind of the first big piece is, as a service business in particular, your gross margin is not usually going to be what your accountant initially presents to you, because usually what they're presenting to you is, here's how much income you brought in, here's all the money that flowed through to other things, like maybe you paid for some ads or you had to buy some stock footage or something like that. And then that they're going to think that that's your gross margin. But what we actually really need to factor in as well is, okay, but what did we have to spend to earn that revenue? So that's kind of the first big piece, is really understanding that margin.
Yeah. And I think that is so super important, because I know in talking to a lot of small business owners, especially when they're getting ready to hire and they're trying to think what they can afford, they're not really factoring in their time, even as a solo person, appropriately when it comes to delivering their service. And their pricing might not be at the right place in order to even be able to pay themselves what they should be worth, even if they weren't the CEO of the business, to pay themselves what they were worth if they were just like a bottom level worker at the business executing this stuff. And I think it's like one of those things is like when you really look at your pricing and possibly adjust your pricing so that it actually makes sense, because you can run your business on it. I know for me personally, last year I raised one of my prices for one of my packages and I was really hesitant. I was just like, oh, I don't know. Can I ask clients for that much money? You know, went through all those things I know a lot of us do when we go to raise prices, especially when we're service-based businesses and we don't have that cost, that real true cost that we can look at. And I did it anyway. And I remember one of my next projects was around the same time that I started doing a lot of tracking of my time, because I really wanted to see where my time was going, to make sure I was, like, as I expanded my business, bringing in the right people. And when I looked back at this one particular project, I was just like, oh my gosh, I am so thankful I raised my price, because that's actually what it costs for me to do this work for them. And sometimes we just don't see what it actually costs for us to do the work, because we're okay, even if don't really like it, without paying ourselves what we're worth, because we're like, that's what it's like to run a business. You don't always get paid what you're worth. You don't always bring home this huge paycheck. There's other advantages. Eventually you'll get there, but we need to take the steps so we can get there.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I know that a lot of your listeners are maybe in that phase of their business where they're still kind of doing a lot of the work. They're wearing a lot of the hats on projects. Maybe they have a few freelancers that help them out, but yeah, they're doing a lot of those jobs. And this is something I encourage anyone that sells services that's still in that solo or micro business mode to do, is to sit down and write out, what are the hats that you typically wear on a project? What are the roles that need to be played? And really think about it in terms of roles. Don't think about it in terms of tasks. This is so important. It's not about what's being done. It's about what is the role that's being played. And you want to think about this in terms of like, who would I hire to do this if I had unlimited and work and unlimited budget to do? And estimate how many hours per role am I going to need to play on this project? So for example, if you were, helping somebody recruit a new employee, you might have, a role that's like a research or perhaps a strategy component where you're helping them understand, what are the requirements of the job and what's the job description going to look like and what kind of candidate are we looking for and what's the acceptance criteria. Then you might have more of like a recruiting function where it's like, okay, we're going to post the job, we're going to go out, we're going to reach out to candidates, we're going to filter them. Then you might have like an interviewer role. So start to think about what are the jobs to be done and then go out and model what would it cost me to actually hire that person. And if you want to be conservative, use the freelance rate. If I only hired freelancers, what would I pay on an hourly basis roughly for that role, right? The strategist might be $150 an hour, whereas the more administrative assistant person that's doing a lot of the mechanical stuff, they might be $20 or $30 an hour. And write that out. And what this will allow you to do is understand, if I was doing none of the work, would this actually be profitable? What is the contribution margin on this project? And what we want to be aiming for is 60 to 70% or higher. So what that means is for every $1 that it costs you to earn something, or for every $1 that you get paid, I should say, you want to spend no more than 30 or 40 cents of that dollar on the people actually doing the work. So that's really important because it sets you up to have the right margin. And the other thing that it does is this really interesting forcing function for you to start to pay attention to, where am I spending my time? And you might start to realize, like, I spend a lot of time doing something that's worth $20 an hour. And it's like, then you start to ask yourself, well, what if all of my time was actually spent doing this thing that we know is worth $150 an hour? It's a really interesting exercise in starting to prioritize buying back your time, identifying where you want to start hiring other people to scale your capacity. And it gets rid of a problem that we see all the time of getting so busy that you're like, hey, it's time to hire. And then realizing all of a sudden, oh, I actually can't afford to, because I never factored that into my pricing. So it's like, let's just take that problem off the table, because you have enough hard stuff to do now of recruiting and hiring and training and onboarding, like all that stuff is gonna suck. So let's just like remove one problem of now you have to change all your pricing too. Let's take care of that at the beginning by just doing this exercise and pricing it in from the start.
Yeah, okay, there's so many things in there that I wanna kind of stress. Is first, I absolutely love that you said like kind of what percentage should go towards your payroll, towards paying people, because I have looked for that number so many times and I feel like it's all like, well, it depends. And this, I'm like, just give me a rough ballpark for a service-based business. Like, what should be going towards paying your people? And so you said 30%, right? Around 30%. Is that what you said?
Yeah. That would be the contribution margin on a per project basis. Now, here's the reason why I want to qualify this. When you look at the profit and loss statement, you should expect your margin to be 10 to 20% lower, because what you're going to absorb there is the cost of gaps in utilization. Maybe you have a little period where it's not that busy, so you're not keeping the team busy. They're going to have holidays, they're going to have vacation, they're going to have sick days. You're going to have maybe times when you pull them in for internal meetings. So there's going to be a cost of non-billable time, essentially, that you're going to want to absorb, but it almost always falls in that 10 to 20%. So this is why we target 70% at the project level, so we can get to 50% on the profit and loss statement. We're usually going to spend another 30-ish percent on overhead, sales and marketing, administration, facilities, and that should leave us with at least 20% on the bottom line. So that's why we want to start at 70. And if you want to have a higher bottom line, then work your way up, and that'll help you get an understanding of how to target the right margins at different levels of the business.
Yes, I guess. Love that. Yes, love that breakdown, because it is like there are like, I remember my husband once worked for a company. He was a software engineer. They were billing out towards their clients and they're like, you have to work 40 billable hours per week. And then, but they were also in a company that says, we believe in work-life balance, so we don't want you working more than 40 hours per week. And then they'd be like, hey, we have a new person that we need to hire. Can you do interviews? And he goes, okay, well, if you're going to take 4 hours of my time for interviews, then I'm not going to have 40 billable hours this week. And they're like, you still need to have 40 billable hours this week, figure it out. And he's like, wait, but which one is it? Do you want me 40 billable hours a week? Do you want me only working 40 hours a week? Do you want me participating in these interviews? And so like that company forgot that there is time where your people are not going to be having kind of billable hours, even if they're maximizing and doing everything that they can to have billable hours that week.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, anybody that's worked in consulting or worked in an agency or something like that 10, 20 years ago, that would have been their experience. And that is, to me, just the result of that business not understanding their model well enough. One of three things is true. Either they're not charging enough money. And so because they don't charge enough money, they have an asinine utilization target, which is them basically saying, well, my employees can pay for that, right? Instead of my instead of our clients paying for the business model being successful, we're going to let our employees subsidize this for us. Or they're just exploiting the team.
Yeah, that's what it is. I love how you just said that. Either your clients pay for it or your team pays for it. And mm-hmm. you know, one of the things we talk about, and I know a lot of people that listen, is they want to be people-focused business owners. They want and they do care about their teams. So you have to think about that. If you really care about your team, why are you letting your team members pay for things that your clients should be paying for? So, and that kind of brings me to one of the second things I wanted to bring up with what you said was, one of the things that I was thinking of is a lot of times we get stuck, I think, when we're in these smaller businesses, is I can't charge as much as some of these bigger businesses because my company is smaller. And maybe I don't have this huge team behind me, but these other companies have these like huge teams, so they can justify their cost. And like, I kind of look at that and says, your client's paying for the output. They're not necessarily paying for how many people are working on that. So if you're giving an output, charge for what is appropriate for what you're delivering. Forget about how many people it takes on your team to actually get that done. So don't charge less, I'm saying, just because you have less people on your team.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot of mindset blocks, I think, in people's way in terms of charging enough money. And you know, the flip side of that is sometimes, yeah, clients are going to say no. And so it's like, okay, well, this is a business problem that needs to be solved now. One of two things is true in that case. Either the value isn't there, and it might not be that your thing isn't valuable. It might just be that it's not valuable to that person that you're talking to. So you need to talk to the person that it is really valuable to, right? Because it's like the pizza shop down the street, they will have a limited budget. You can't just like manifest an unlimited budget for them to pay us $100,000 a month to do their Facebook ads. But there is a company out there spending $100,000 a month on Facebook ads. And so that's a business problem to solve, is how do we find a problem that has outsized value and charge a price that allows us to have good margins and that delivers an outsized value to the client. And that shit's hard. Like, that's business. That's why 98% of people fail and the 2% that don't make a ton of money. That's what we need to figure out. It's really not easy. But to your point, a lot of times it's our own mindset, and you'd be surprised at how often people will get on board if you just lean in and start making those asks.
Yes. I love that. Okay. So I want to make sure we kind of shift and we have enough time to talk about kind of those other metrics and everything, because we're talking a lot about the financial parts, but as you mentioned, there's operations, there's all those other things, the marketing data, and that we should really be tracking. And I want to focus a lot on the operations, because that's really where a lot of the team and stuff comes in. So let's jump into what we should be tracking in that portion of our business.
Yeah. So to preface this, I'll come back and quickly summarize what we've talked about on the financials, which we kind of got into, which is, you know, we want to make sure we have a good enough margin on the thing that we sell. We do that by targeting, you know, roughly 70% at a per unit level. So per engagement, per retainer, per client, that should get us to somewhere around 50% or higher on the profit and loss statement. That means we can afford to pay about 30% of our revenue towards overhead, which should be lots. And then we have a profit left over. Now, the problem with most people's P&Ls, as we mentioned before, is there isn't a difference between that gross margin and their bottom line. So they just see money coming in, very little coming out. And then what's happening in the middle is kind of a black box. And when we start to look at our financials this way, 9 out of 10 times, what we're going to realize is, oh, my margin's actually just not that good on the things that I'm selling. It's not that I'm spending way too much on overhead. It's not that I need to, you know, switch out this $100 a month software tool for the $50 version. Like, there's just not that much juice in the squeeze. But the problem when we look at the financials that way is that's where we tend to focus. But the opportunity is improving the gross margin of the thing that we sell. And there are three ways to do that. There's only three when we're talking about a service-based business. The first way is by looking at decreasing what we call our average cost per hour. And so average cost per hour is really a proxy for decreasing that thing we talked about earlier, which is delivery cost. And so the question here is, what if we could spend less money to earn the revenue that is coming into the business today? And the way that we accomplish that is we use less expensive labor to earn that same revenue. And that's a function of gradually trying to focus on decreasing the average cost per hour on everything that we do. So let's zoom out and talk about that first lever, average cost per hour. What does it mean? How do you calculate it? The first thing is the calculation. So it's very simple to measure. And all three of these metrics, by the way, have the same feature, which is you can look at them for any time period and you can look at them for any cross-section of the business. So what I mean by that is you could look at one person, you could look at a group of people, and you could look at it for a day, a week, a month, a year. The calculation is always the same. And that's by design. We want to make this really simple and allow you to kind of look at anything. So for average cost per hour, you could look at payroll, and that's total payroll. So that includes benefits and taxes and all those things. And you divide that by capacity. So let's say I was trying to measure your average cost per hour, Jamie, and you had $100,000 a year salary, and your capacity in a year is 2,080 hours. So that's 40 hours a week multiplied by 52 weeks a year. So I would divide that $100,000 by 2,080, and that would give me an average cost per hour of about $48. So every time that you log an hour to a project, I'm logging a cost to that project of $48. Now, conversely, if I had another person on the team that was, let's say, a junior version of your job, and they made $50,000 a year, their average cost per hour would be half of yours. And so the game here with lowering average cost per hour is we're asking the question, what would need to be true for more of the tasks on this kind of work to be done by that junior person that's less expensive? And usually that comes back to things like, is the process clear? Do we have templates? You know, is there maybe technology we can use to leverage this? What are the things that we can do to decrease the level of judgment that's required in order to complete this? And usually less judgment means we need less experience, and usually less experience means that person is less expensive. And so by systemizing these things and offloading more and more of the work to more junior people, you get to focus on the things that light you up, that are high value, that, you know, really are in your pay grade. Somebody else gets to get more experience and do more things. And we benefit because as we scale the team, instead of having to hire 15 Jamies at $100,000 per year, we can hire maybe three Jamies at $100,000 per year, and the other seven people only cost 50. And so our costs are not increasing at the same rate as our revenue, but we're still getting the same types of things done. So that's kind of the first big idea. The first big lever is how do we decrease our cost to deliver? And average cost per hour is kind of the operational leading indicator to help us understand where we have the opportunity to do that and how well we're doing that on a tighter basis.
Ooh, I like that. And I think that ties a little bit into one of the things that I talk about is when we're identifying what position you should be adding next, what I always encourage people when they're making their really early hires, and this really should flow throughout, is your first hire, your second hire, what position you should be bringing on, what positions are going to give you that best ROI. So I think it kind of ties into that cost per, you know, per hour of like what they're doing, because there's some people who are like, well, yeah, I could use this type of help. But if you can't afford it, or it's not going to give you that good ROI, you're going to feel like it's draining you, that you're not getting that good return on your investment. So I think when you're looking at that way and you're saying, how can I get these lower level tasks? Like before you mentioned the $20 tasks versus like the $200 tasks, how can you get the $20 tasks off your plate and delegate effectively because you're trusting them and you're letting them do it versus going to do it yourself to now managing it and using the same amount of time to manage it as do it.
Yeah, 100%. And the other thing there to think about is like, how do you turn a $100 task into a $20 task? And that is really also such an important lever of like, well, this used to be really tough because we had no process and it was really uncertain, but we fixed those things. And now almost anybody can come in and do this without having all the experience that I have. And that's where we really start to increase the margin, where the number of expensive tasks is just going down. And that compounds the effectiveness of, as you mentioned, starting to bring those people in and delegating things.
Yes. So what's next?
Okay, so we talked about average cost per hour. That's the first one. That's related to decreasing costs. The next two levers I'm going to talk about are related to increasing the amount of revenue that you can earn without changing the costs. So the first one I want to talk about is what we call average billable rate. And there's some people listening to this that are thinking, well, I don't bill by the hour, so I'm going to stop listening now. That would be the incorrect thing to do. Average billable rate is a measure of earning efficiency that works across all billing models. And just like the last metric we talked about, you can look at any unit of work within the business. You could look at a single hour. You could look at a whole project. You could look at a client. You could look at a group of projects or clients. And you could do this for any time period, a day, a week, a month, a quarter, a year. The way we calculate average billable rate is we take the agency gross income or the adjusted gross income that we've earned in a given time period. So that's how much money we collected, and then we pull out pass-through expenses. So let's say you got paid $10,000 by a client to run a Facebook campaign, and you spent $5,000 of that on Facebook ads. What's left over is $5,000. That would be your agency gross income. So that's what we're looking at, is how much did we collect for the work that we're measuring here? And then we divide that by what we call delivery hours. So how many hours did we spend in order to get it done? And there's some people listening to this are like, well, that sounds a lot like a billable hour. Why don't you just call it a billable hour? And it's like, because I don't care if we billed the client or not. I care if it was required to get the work done. Because if you do bill by the hour, you've probably been in this situation, right? Where it's like, well, we billed the client for 100 hours, but we kind of screwed something up and we didn't want to upset the client. And so, you know, we spent 125, but we only billed them for 100. And it's important when we're using this metric to measure the efficiency of the business that we look at all of the time that it actually cost us to do this, so we can really understand the efficiency that we earned revenue with. So as an example, if I had a section of clients and they all paid me $15,000 and I spent 200 hours to earn that $15,000, then my average billable rate would be not very good. $15,000 divided by 200, $75 an hour. Whereas if I earn that 15K in half the amount of time, in 100 hours, I would have made $150 for every hour that I worked. And this is a powerful metric because now I can start to compare things. I might see that, like, oh yeah, there's some clients that they pay us 15 grand and we spend 200 hours to get it done. And we have other clients that pay us the same amount of money and we get it done in half the time. And all of a sudden you start to think, well, if I sold all of the time that me and my team have available for twice as much money, we would make twice as much money. And it sounds like it's too simple to be true, but that's the math. That is how it works. And it's not necessarily that you're charging more money. It might just be that you're getting things done quicker and more efficiently. So this is a really great way to start to look at the business and see, where are we actually getting more return on every hour that we spend for the different types of things that we do?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's good. I think, like, one thing that came to mind for my business when you're speaking about that was, when one of the things that we complete for our clients is we do research on what should this position be paid, what compared to, like, what's out there in the market. And we also research potential job boards to put it on outside of just the standard ones. What are the niche job boards? And when I would do it, I would find myself going down a rabbit hole. So it would take me a lot of time. And when I had a team member do it, she could get both those done in an hour, where I'd be 3 hours into it and I'd be like, maybe I just need one more. Let me look at some more. And at the end of the day, we'd come back with the same information. It's just, yeah. I would go down the spiraling rabbit hole doing it. And she was so good at identifying it and putting those conclusions together right away. So to me, it's like, that might be, and let me know if, like, this is on the right path, like a way of kind of reducing those hours, because you're giving it to the person who could do it well in less time.
Absolutely. You know, that's a great strategy. And then a lot of stuff we talked about earlier is also usually going to have this impact on average billable rate. So better process means you can do things quicker. Maybe you have some templates. Maybe you invest in some automation. You hire some people that are experts and get it done quicker. And all of those things mean that if you can spend half as much time to get the same things done, you can do twice as many of those.
Yes.
So yeah, like, that's the beautiful thing.
Yeah. And that's like, you said something exactly like I was going to say. It is, you hire the experts, because we talk a lot on this podcast with signs that it's time to hire. And one of it is, there needs to be knowledge or skill that you don't have. And there comes a point in your business where you need to stop learning and let the expert do it. And we talk about, because your time is valuable. And not only do you have to take the time to learn it, you have to take the time to try to execute it. You're probably not going to do it well, which means you're going to spend time redoing it, which means you're probably going to even spend more time critiquing your own work. And the amount of just hours it takes for you to do this thing adds up, where that expert you could have hired, even if they're like a high cost expert, it probably still costs you less because they took less time than it would have taken for you to do that same work.
Yep. A mentor of mine once described this as hiring the people that play at the things that you work at. And, you know, especially in creative disciplines, that's something I'm looking for all the time, is like, is this the thing they're doing on weekends when they're not at work? Because they just love it that much. And when you hire that person, man, it's such a game changer, because, like, they're going to continue to learn and develop and invest in their skill set and innovate on your behalf within your business on their own time. And they're happy to do it because this is just like the thing that they're passionate about and that they want to invest their life in. And it's just such a powerful force for increasing the efficiency in the business, to your point.
Yes.
So that we've talked about two metrics now. We talked about average cost per hour, which is about lowering the cost to earn your revenue. And then we talked about one powerful one, which is about raising the amount of revenue that your team can earn without changing cost, which is average billable rate. And again, the TLDR on average billable rate is if you can make more money on average for every hour that your team works, your team can make more money. And so if you focus on spending less time to earn that same amount of money, you could increase your prices. It's another good way to increase that number. Or you just focus on the things that you're noticing are more efficient. And any of those things can start to raise that average billable rate. And it means that you're earning more money without changing your cost structure or spending more time. So that's number two. Number three is the infamous utilization metric that we talked about earlier. And for my Star Wars nerds that are listening, this is what I call the dark saber of service-based metrics, because it has great power, but you must use it with great responsibility, because it can be misused and cause the issues that we talked about earlier of people being overworked and people being held to unrealistic expectations. And so it's still important, but we want to be careful about how we measure it and how we use it. And so utilization is really looking at the picture of how much capacity do we buy from our team in a given period of time, and what percentage of that capacity is being used to earn the average billable rate that we just talked about. So as an example, you know, if I was to hire you, Jamie, for a full-time job, I'd be hiring you for 2,080 hours per year. That's usually what the contract says, is I'm going to buy 2,080 hours of your life, and I'm going to pay you a fixed rate for that amount of time. And then I'm going to turn around and try to sell some portion of that time at a profit. That way everybody wins. You get a stable income, we make a profit as a business, and our client is happy because they get the work done that they want done. That's how the game is supposed to work. But of course, the challenge with that is if I can't find enough work, then I'm still going to have to pay you because that's the agreement that we had. But we might not make a profit as a business, and that becomes problematic. The other way that this can become problematic is what you described earlier, which is where I say, well, I expect 2,080 hours of your year to be billable. And you're like, well, wait a second, what about vacation and time off and holidays and all the other internal stuff that you asked me to do, like joining the weekly team meeting and coaching other people and doing interviews? So we need to make sure that this is balanced and realistic, and that the percentage of time that our team spends earning the amount of money per hour that we earn on average gets us to an amount of revenue that allows us to have that gross margin we talked about earlier. And so the simple calculation for this is, what is the amount of delivery time that we spend and what is the capacity that we have? And again, you could look at this for one person, a group of people, and you could look at it for a day, a month, a week, a quarter. And generally in a service-based business, what we're aiming for is a utilization as an entire team on an annual basis of anywhere from 50 to 65%. And I know that seems low. And the reason it seems low is because we're leaving all of the capacity in. So we're not going to remove your holidays and time off from this capacity number, because we need to see the cost of that in here. And we need to set your utilization rate to account for those things. We're not going to take off sick days. We're not going to take off the internal time. We're leaving all of that in. We're not even going to remove, if we're looking at the whole team, the admin person or the salesperson that does zero work for clients. We're leaving everybody in there so that we can see the cost of that time, and we could set our utilization rate to account for those things and allow for them to happen, and to be honest with ourselves about, is the business going to be profitable after we account for all of those things that still need to happen in order for us to run the business and in order for people to, you know, be taken care of essentially as stakeholders in this business. So that's utilization. That's the third one. And the simple idea there is, the more of your team's time that can be deployed against earning revenue, the more revenue you can earn. But all of that is, of course, within limits and within context. And it's not just about cranking that up as high as you can. It's about getting it to a place that is ideal, but realistic, and still allows you to have the culture that you want at your business.
Ooh, I love it. Yeah. There's so many things that I thought of with that is, like, first off, I know many small business owners are like, we give our employees like 5 days vacation because we can't afford to give any more. But I think then it's like, as you said, it's like the dark saber of, you know, with the metrics and everything, because yeah, you can do that. And maybe that helps with your utilization metric, but are your employees going to be happy? So, you know, that you have to factor in as well. And I think it's a real powerful thing to look at is, what is taking your employees away from being able to do the quote unquote billable work, and how can we reduce that? Like, what are a lot of people's biggest complaints? Meetings. Are meetings actually being, are they effective use of time, or are they a time waster? You know, what's going on that are the time wasters that you think need to happen? I remember being in a meeting once when I was pretty young in my career back in corporate, and it was something that I never thought of. And it was a leadership meeting, and they looked around and they'll go, wow, there's a lot of money being spent on this meeting. And I was just like, we're in the conference room of our building that we own. Like, what do you mean? And they're like, think of what everybody makes. We are in a 3-hour meeting. So how much money the company is paying for all of us to be in this meeting, because none of us are getting work done because we're here.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, never thought of that.
Totally. And it, you're right. There's all kinds of opportunities to try to decrease the administrative burden on the team and try to get them more focused on client work. Another big lever is a thing that I call client dilution, where you might have two people that are working the exact same number of billable hours, but the chances are if one person is working, let's call it 36 billable hours a week, let's go with a high number, but it's one client and one project, they're working on the same thing for 36 hours a week, that person is probably not very stressed, to be honest. Whereas if you have another person that's working 36 hours billable per week, but they're spread across 9 different things, that person is going to feel significantly more stressed. And so if you want to increase your utilization, one of the best ways to do it is to just try to reduce the amount of dilution in terms of the number of clients that an individual needs to switch context between within the run of a day or a week. And in some cases, even leaving the client dilution the same, but reducing the context switching can have a similar effect, where you come in for this one day, and this one day you're just focused on this one thing. And then the next day you can focus on the next thing. And those little things of reducing the context switching, reducing the handoffs and the dependencies can go a long way in allowing your team to be highly productive without it actually feeling like they're working that hard. And conversely, you know, giving them all kinds of context switching can make it feel a lot worse than it actually is.
Oh, I love that. And it's something where, you know, I know a lot of people, they focus on, like, they'll do things like time blocking or things like that so they can stay focused on a task. So I feel like that's kind of what you're, a little bit of what you're saying is, how can you stay focused and not be switching here to there? And I even know there's times when I'm doing client work, when we're doing kind of the strategy planning and creation, I might say, well, I could do 30 minutes here, I could do 30 minutes there. Oh, wait, if I hold off and do this on Thursday instead of trying to cram it in on Tuesday and Wednesday, I currently have a 5-hour block that I can block off on my calendar and do it, get it all done right there, probably not even take the entire 5 hours and be done, versus like, okay, where was I? All right. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, I added an interview question into this interview that I added into the previous interview because I forgot, because I didn't do it all at once.
Totally. Yeah. It's such a powerful lever. And the other thing that I want to just speak to here with utilization is there are only two ways to improve this metric. The first is decreasing your capacity, and that's corporate speak for laying people off. And you know, that's going to happen sometimes. We hired a bunch of people, we're just not getting the sales that we need to keep them busy. And so in that case, one of the things that we can do is to say, okay, let's reduce the number of team members that we're paying for while we don't actually have enough work for them to do. Of course, we want to avoid that. So the other side of this coin is we can sell more work. But the important word here is sell more work, because I'm sure we've both seen this in a firm where the utilization's not that high. And then a manager goes to their team and says, hey, I need you all to improve your utilization. So what does the team do? Well, they just start spending more time doing the same things they were doing before. The profitability of the business is not changing in this case. We just actually make everything worse, because now the team's busier than they need to be. The client thinks that this is the level of service that they can come to expect for what they're paying. And now if we want to improve profitability, we have two problems to solve. We got to go back to getting efficient, and then we actually have to fill up that utilization. So the only effective strategy for improving utilization in a way that actually moves the needle on profitability is we actually are doing work that we're being paid for. That's the key thing. And this is why I really don't believe in holding the team to a utilization target. This is a management metric. This is evaluating our ability as a management team to staff at the right time with the right skills, bring in enough work to keep them busy, and effectively resource people against things and make it clear what they should be focused on. It's not our team's responsibility to hire and fire people at the right time. It's not their responsibility to go out and get the right work, and it's not their responsibility to resource against things. That's a managerial function, and that's why I think utilization is a managerial metric.
Yeah, I see that. I totally agree. All right. I know we're really coming up before to the time where we need to start wrapping up. But there is one thing that I just wanted to make sure we touch on before we have to wrap up for today. And there's a lot of stuff here. We talk about utilization. We talk about all these things and where are how people are spending their time. And we've kind of danced around a little bit of like tracking time, being aware of things. So I think that kind of brings us to this idea of timesheets and asking sometimes our team to be tracking their times. And for some businesses, this is something they've had ingrained in their processes from the start because they're like, we're on billable hours. We need to keep track of everything. We got this. Other people say, I have never had my team track their time before. How do I go about doing this where the team members feel the value of it and not just feel like I'm adding something else to their plate?
It's a great question and one that we could do a whole other podcast episode on, but I'll try to give you the concise answer. The first thing I want to clarify is when we talk about time tracking, what do we actually mean? Because there's a lot of conversation in the industry about time tracking that seems to allude to the idea that it's inherently linked to two things, that it's inherently linked to billing by the hour, which it's not, or that it's inherently linked to timesheets, which is one methodology for tracking time, but it's not the only way to track time. And so I want to make it clear that when we talk about tracking time, the definition of that to me is creating a model of where time is being spent. It doesn't matter how you bill the client, and it doesn't matter actually if you use timesheets or not. All we're talking about here is let's create a model to understand where time is being spent. And in a service-based business, I would argue that that's pretty important because time is your largest P&L expense. So it would behoove you to understand where that's going. And you can imagine it's pretty empowering as a business to know where it's going. And so how do we create the buy-in with the team? I would find a problem in the business that everyone's aware of and facilitate the conversation around that problem that inherently leads us to tracking time. So for example, man, we keep going, you know, over budget on projects. Everyone's having to work evenings and weekends because like we're not seeing these things coming. We're not planning for enough time to get these projects done. And if let's say that's happening, we sit down with the team and we go, yeah, this is definitely really a problem. Like we just keep getting caught off guard and everyone's working overtime to try and meet deadlines. And it would be really nice if we had a better idea of how long it was going to take to do things. How might we do that? It's pretty hard to imagine that that conversation is going to go anywhere other than, well, do you think it would be helpful if we actually started keeping track of how much time it was taking to do things and maybe looking for patterns in that data and then maybe using that data to better understand how to estimate next time or maybe looking at things that are going wrong and trying to fix the processes that are causing us to go over budget. Like, but start with finding a problem, using time data to solve that problem. And then the light bulbs start to go off and people realize like, oh yeah, this is actually kind of useful. Like when we use it for ourselves, for our own benefit. And then you might start to tackle other problems like, oh, hey, you know, we're really struggling with, you know, these kinds of projects not being that profitable. Oh yeah, well, that's interesting. Why don't we pay attention to where our time is going? And then maybe we can find ways to improve that. And as we solve problems together with the team and we close the loop, that's a really important piece. We don't just ask them to track their time and then we never show them the time data. We never show them how it's being used. We never talk about how it's, we actually sit back down with them and look at it together from the same side of the table and say, this is really interesting. What can we learn from this? That's how we do it. That's how we create the buy-in. Yes. But the biggest mistake I see people make is they just say, hey, everyone, I want you to track your time. And then it goes into a black box. And then it's up to the team to create their own story in their mind about how it's being used. And very rarely will that story be a flattering one. And so the best way to take control of that narrative is to actually get them involved in the conversations that happen around that data so they can see how it's being used. And it should be used for things like trying to make sure that they're not over-resourced, trying to make sure that we price and scope things properly so we're setting good expectations, trying to make sure that we're profitable as a business so we don't have to do layoffs every time that we lose a client or we, you know, we don't close a big deal that was in the pipeline and that we can pay people well and that we can give them raises and benefits. Those are all the reasons we should be doing this. And when they can see that that's how it's being used, then it's much more likely that they're going to get bought into the process in the first place.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Now, this isn't an example of time tracking. It was more kind of other data tracking within a project where we were looking at wait time, lead time, completion times, all those things within a project. And so we were having our team manually track data because we were the first team that was doing this. And they're like, okay, once we figure out what we should be tracking, we'll figure out a way where a lot of it could be tracked automatically in the system. But so they had to manually do it. And I was constantly having to follow up to be like, you didn't enter in this for this project. You didn't enter in this. Like, why didn't you do this? Why? And it was so much hunting to find out, okay, just give me the data. And finally, I realized that the reason they weren't doing it is because they just felt like it was a chore because they had no idea what was being done with this data. Now, I was using the data and I was reporting up in the organization, and there were great conversations happening because of this data, but my team didn't know that. So I started filling my team in. That same presentation I'd give to senior leadership, I gave to my team to said, okay, here's what we talked about. Here's what I'm showing. Sometimes I started doing it before I'd go to senior leadership to say, is there anything here I'm incorrect about? Fill me in. And because they started realizing what was happening because of this data, besides something where it was like, oh, I thought I filled that in, my mistake, it was, they started, like, everything was there. I didn't have to track things down ever again because they saw the value in it. And another thing that it allowed us to do, because I had that data, which I'm assuming when your team's tracking their time as well, I could start to see proactively when things were taking too long. And I could go in and say, what's going on here? This thing where normally it takes a day to get this done, we're on day 5 and it's still just sitting there. Like, why is it still in this hold pattern? And then sometimes because I had that data and I could go and proactively talk to them, they were then able to fill me in on things that were going on, where then maybe as the manager of the team and having other resources, it's like, okay, how can we work around this? And sometimes being like, well, it's the client just not delivering us. We've followed up, we've called, we've looped in sales, we've done everything we can. There's nothing we can do. But I was able to proactively see things that were going astray. And then once again, because I was proactively doing that, it trained my team to proactively do that. So it got to a point where I didn't have to see it in the data. My team was coming to me as like, hey, just want to let you know, you might see this one sitting there for a while. This is what's going on. And it just created this huge layer of trust and transparency between myself and my team members.
That's such a great anecdote, because I really, really strongly believe this. So many people talk about timesheet compliance in this tactical way of, oh, you got to gamify it and get a better tool and have better reminders and, you know, penalize people for not submitting their time. But the most effective thing that can be done is exactly what you described, which is just closing the loop and showing the data to your team. And in many cases, even when you know the data is bad, just pretend that you don't know that and be like, oh, wow, it took us half as much time to do this project. I'm going to go sell twice as many of them next month. And then they'll stop you. They'll be like, well, hold on, I didn't really get all my time in. And then you can be like, oh, geez, well, you know, that's kind of, you know, difficult for me to know what's going on. Like, do you see how that might be the case? And to your point, the problem will just start to solve itself. And so if you're having timesheet compliance issues, this is by far the most effective thing to do, is just start talking to the team about it.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, we really need to wrap up because I know we're coming to the end of our scheduled time together, Russell. So tell everybody how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah. If you want to learn more about this stuff, we have a whole bunch of free resources at parakeeto.com/toolkit, where we have training videos and templates and cheat sheets and calculators and spreadsheets and everything that you need to start measuring all the metrics that I talked about today on your own for free without having to pay us for anything. So if you're interested in implementing some of these things, I encourage you to go check that out. We've also got a podcast called the Agency Profit Podcast, where we talk about these kinds of things all the time. And if you have questions, follow me on LinkedIn and reach out, and I'm always happy to help you out in the DMs.
Yes. And of course, all the links for everything will be in the show notes over at growingyourteam.com. So final question, the question I love to ask all my guests. We've all had leaders or managers that have stood out to us. Think of a leader or manager that has stood out to you and share one thing about them.
Yeah. I mean, I've been blessed to have an incredible amount of mentors and great managers in my life. But it's hard for me to mention anyone other than Dan Martell, who I've had the pleasure of working very closely with for a long time. And I think the most important thing that he taught me was really how to think about buying back my time and doing it from a place of service, not from a place of, you know, feeling like things were beneath me, but flipping that mindset to say, if I'm going to be able to do the things that have the highest impact on my team and on my family and on my life, then I need to create space for that. And the way that I do that is by giving the opportunity to somebody else to do the thing that they play at, that I work at. And so, yeah, big ups to Dan. He's been a huge inspiration.
Yes. Way to have that encouragement to delegate. Yes. So you could focus on the right things. All right, Marcel, thank you so much for joining us today on the Growing Your Team podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jamie. It was a pleasure.
Are you ready to hire a new team member for your business and you want to ensure you hire the person who can succeed in the role, make you happy, and positively impact your bottom line? Then let's talk and see how growing your team can help you master the art of hiring. Through bespoke hiring frameworks and comprehensive guidance, you will learn how to attract candidates who have the passion you desire and the skills needed to succeed. At Growing Your Team, women entrepreneurs and leaders work with us to help them expand their unique businesses by teaching them how to hire like a pro. Let's connect and see how we can help you. Send me an email at jamie@growingyourteam.com. That's Jamie, J-A-M-I-E, @growingyourteam.com, or head on over to growingyourteam.com/jumpstart, with jumpstart being all one word, and let's talk about how you can become a confident leader who hires right every single time.